Can I just say thanks to everyone for attending this course of lectures. It's very good for everyone to hang in there across two terms. And if you got half as much pleasure out of listening to them as I got out of giving them, I'll be well satisfied. We're following the same format as in previous lectures. We have as discussant here today Mr. Will Hutton, who sits there before you modestly. Will Hutton's probably well known to most people in the audience. He has a long-standing column in the Observer, the Sunday Observer newspaper. He's written very, very widely on especially issues of how you create responsible capitalism. But this shades over into the theme of democracy, which is the theme of what we're talking about today. A few years ago, he wrote a book which turned out to be a big bestseller called The State We're In, which is based about the UK, but by inference had a lot about what kind of society industrial countries should aim to be. He's currently working on a book which is almost finished, I think, which says that American capitalism is not all that nice and that European capitalism is preferable. And the title of that... The title of that is...
The World We're In.
Oh, God, The World We're In. Oh, well, very good.
I write
We're In. One of the problems of this discussant format, could though it is that people like me, academics, are unable to speak for 35 minutes. And last time, I didn't quite get back to the themes with which I started the lecture. And since I got a number of interesting emails about it, let me just begin this lecture by concluding the last one. You remember in the last lecture I was talking about sexuality, relationships, the family, and I counterposed two possible political models which I said have dominated much thinking about the family. On the one hand, a liberal type model which says let a thousand flowers bloom, any kind of relationship should be accepted and tolerated. And the opposing one, which said family is in crisis, we have to revert to the traditional family, the family is the bedrock of society, and so forth. And I argued that each of those views was in some part mistaken. You can't return to the traditional family because it was based upon a relationship between the sexes and lack of rights for children, which are not compatible with either the framework of international law or what I would take to be the ethics of family life today. But I didn't mean in what I said to argue that the example of the gay relationship I mentioned at the beginning was an example of let a thousand flowers bloom relationship. What I was arguing for was a new ethics of freedom and responsibility in family life, where the two are balanced out. You can't simply let a thousand flowers bloom because you have to protect the rights of children. You need to create a form of family life where there is real equality between the sexes. Such an ethics has to be protected in law. And for me, that would be the framework of what I call a democracy of the emotions at the end of the lecture. A democracy of the emotions is not, of course, a formal political democracy of the kind that we're talking about today, but it means effectively having a new ethics of family life which recognizes equality, participation, communication as the basis of what good relationships and strong families should be like. Therefore, strong families won't look very much like traditional families, but we can rebuild the structures of family life around such an ethics, or so I believe. Well, the theme of democracy of the emotions obviously connects with the wider theme of democratization, which we are talking about today. With this, I think you have to start with the recognition that the term democracy, the concept of democracy, is one of the key words of the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century. That is, the expansion of the idea of democracy is as characteristic of the last 100 or so years as is the expansion of industrialism and a market economy. The relationship between these is complex, but the expansion of the notion of democracy is a dramatic feature of world society over that lengthy period. It's very important to recognize that it wasn't always so. the idea and the reality of democracy was essentially contested in the late 18th century in Europe and elsewhere. That is to say, governing elites in the late 18th century and well into the 20th century resisted both the idea of democracy and the reality of democratic institutions. Democracy now is such a popular notion, it's very hard to refuse the idea of democracy now, at least in a nominal sense. If you're the government of almost any state in the world, you find very few states in the world which do not have the term democracy in their makeup. There are a few, but there aren't very many. But it wasn't like that at all. The idea and the reality of democracy had to be struggled for. In the early years of the 20th century, democracy was confined to a small number of industrial countries. Those who believed in democracy for their own countries did not believe in democracy for the domains elsewhere in the world which they colonized. The principle of democracy was not extended to the colonial domains of the industrial countries, so it was a very partial aspect, really, of global society. Moreover, until you get the period between the 1920s and the 1950s, democracy in most industrial countries only extended to half the population. That is to say, women did not have the vote in most industrial countries until just after the Second World War, the period between 1919 up until actually 1950, I think was the last industrial country in the world, was Switzerland, where the women got the vote. Can't remember exact date that was, but it was quite late on. Until you had the full inclusion of women, you had nothing like a complete democratization, even in the Western world. As I say, the rest of the world was largely excluded. All this has changed and is changing over the past 30 or so years. What is democracy? Well, political scientists sitting in this audience will know that the idea of democracy is a multiplex one. There are many notions of democracy in political theory. They will know that there are many aspects of democratization. So for purposes of simplicity, I'll take what I call a minimal definition of democracy in this lecture. I shall mean by democracy a political system which has the following three characteristics. First, that there are multiple political parties in the political system rather than a one-party state, that there is a plurality of political parties. Second, that there are open and free elections in which there is substantive right to vote, which is able to be exercised by all of those eligible within the population. And third, that there is an established system of civil liberties and civil rights which is effectively protected constitutionally and effectively protected by an apparatus of law. You could add numerous other characteristics to this definition, but I'll use it as a minimal definition, a minimal level of democracy, which will allow one to characterize a political system as democratic. But you should recognize there are many, many problems and complexities around this. Now, if you take such a minimal definition of democracy, and you look at the period that I've been concentrating on in all these lectures, the period that I'm calling the global age, the last 30 or so years, you see remarkable changes. Over that 30 years, using at least a minimal definition of democracy, such as I've just given, the world has become much more democratic than it was before. We have many studies of this carried out over the past little while. One major study, for example, published just before the year 2000, came up with the finding that of the something like 192 states in the world at the end of the 20th century, about 117 of them were democratic in terms of the criteria I just mentioned. The proportion of states that are recognisably democratic over this period has become three times as high as it was before. There are three times as many recognisably democratic states in the world in the year 2000 as there were in the year 1970, even allowing for the fact that there are more states in the world, because there are more states because the breakup of the Soviet Union and other changes led to an expansion of the number of countries in the world. But even if you factor that out, there are still roughly three times as many democracies today as there they were. Over this period, nearly 90 countries have transferred from recognizably authoritarian rule, in the majority of cases military rule, around about the late 1960s, early 1970s, to democratic government, at least again as measured by a minimalist interpretation of this term. These, I take it, are real and substantial changes. This process of global democratization is something that has to be understood, but of course one has to enter various qualifications about it. We don't know how far these changes are permanent. There have been cycles of democratization before, after all, which have gone into reverse. If you look at the history of Latin American countries, for example, a number of prominent Latin American countries have experienced cycles of democracy, but democracy has succumbed to a return to authoritarian rule or military rule of one kind or another. Now, you look at the situation in Argentina today, you look at the economic crisis, the serious, very difficult economic crisis which Argentina is facing, and you have to ask the question, will the country be able to sustain the transition to democracy which it had achieved? And of course, you have to recognize that the transition to democracy is not an all or nothing thing. In most countries, you have the persistence of some of the practices, including the forms of corruption which existed previously, and they were and are quite visible in Argentina. I hope it's true to say that Argentina will not relapse back into authoritarian rule, but it is of course an open question, and it is for quite a range of other countries around the world which have experienced a transition to democracy. However, I think we're not just talking of a cycle. My view is, for what it's worth, that is, a substantial proportion of states that have made a clear transition somewhere close to democracy or to full democracy will stay that way. The reason being that they've made substantial institutional changes, which I think it would be very difficult to reverse. Take as an example those countries which many Democrats in Latin America look to when they consider processes of how you move from military and authoritarian rule to democratic rule. The three countries in Europe which have done this since the late 1960s, these being Spain, Portugal, and Greece. I think in the case of Spain, Portugal, and Greece, to my mind, a clear transition has been made. Those countries have an established framework of democratic institutions. I think it's very hard to see any of those three relapsing back at some future point, short of cataclysmic changes in the wider world, into the kind of authoritarian system which marked them before. But it is an open question. We don't know how far there is a cycle and how far there is a genuine structural transition. The reason why I think there is a genuine structural transition in world society, I'll give very shortly. Second, however, you have to recognize that there are many states around the edges of democracy which are claiming the label democracy, but which are very far short of meeting even the minimalist criteria that I mentioned. Well, some are closer than others. So when you look at Russia, when you look at Indonesia, when you look at Romania, when you look at Korea, you have countries which are plainly moving in a democratic direction, but some of those countries, arguably, I don't want to tread on any particular toes, but some of those countries are arguably not liberal democracies in the sense in which we'd understand it in the West, I think, meeting the criteria I mentioned. They are rather what some political scientists have called illiberal democracies. Illiberal democracies are countries which are attempting to make a transition to a democratic framework, but are finding it very hard to do so and are marked by the persistence of traits of authoritarianism, subversion of elections, the curtailment of civil liberties, which mean that there is, as it were, more of an empty shell of democracy rather than a true process of democratization. If there is a structural change, as I think on the whole there is in world society, why should this have happened? Well, I would at least submit to you, and I can only sort of assert it rather than justify it in detail in context of a 35-minute lecture. I think the reasons for the expansion of democracy are bound up with the changes I've been analyzing throughout these lectures associated with the impact of globalization broadly defined. Globalization, as I tried to stress in these lectures, is not just the expansion of the global marketplace. It's probably not even primarily the expansion of the global marketplace. It's driven above all by the communications revolution. In the world at large, there is emerging something like a global information society. Even poorer people in the most marginalized sections of the world are able to tune into global communications. If you doubt this, look at what happened in Afghanistan, with 70% of the population at certain points listening to the BBC World Service, including a large proportion of the very poorest people in Afghanistan. In a global information society, an emerging global information society, it seems to me it's much more difficult for governments to treat citizens as passive. It's much more difficult for governments to treat citizens in an authoritarian way. And it's very hard for a society to compete either politically or economically in the wider world if it does not introduce more fluidity and participation. Essentially, what happened in the Soviet Union was that the authoritarian system in the Soviet Union, which worked in a certain way pretty well during a certain period of the evolution of industrial society, became radically dysfunctional with the emergence of a global information economy and a global information society and a worldwide knowledge-based economy. And I traced that out a bit in a previous lecture. So I think to my mind, there is an integral connection between the expansion of globalization, the expansion of democracy, although it is not a simple and primitive connection. It is a complex one, and in every part of the world it is mediated by local experience, by local conflicts, and by the persistence and sometimes the return of forms of authoritarianism, which are the very antithesis of democratic government. However, I think at the same time, as one might say, or I hope you might at least accept plausibility of the claim that there's a connection between globalization and democracy, I think you encounter a paradox of democratic institutions. That paradox is that at the same time as democracy becomes expanded across the world, it seems to become subverted in its heartlands. That is, those countries which have established democratic institutions seem to be experiencing a crisis of democracy. And the crisis of democracy, of course, has been much discussed over the past two decades or so, first of all among political scientists and latterly more generally in the media in this country and in many other countries too. Why should one think there is a crisis of democracy? Well, there are several reasons for believing that this could be the case. First of all, if you look at studies of the industrial countries, levels of political participation over the past 30 years have been declining. Not in all industrial countries, but in most of them, this is true. For example, levels of voting in national elections and also in local elections or regional elections has gone down over that period in something like 70% of the OECD countries, showing that you're not dealing with an individual thing, you're dealing with a structural issue there. Levels of political participation seem to be falling most among the younger generation. You might have seen in the newspaper yesterday, the Labour Party here reacting to a decline in participation of younger people, especially among party membership, Labour Party. Very hard to get younger people to sign up for Labour Party membership. Completely impossible, I'm happy to say, to get younger people to sign up to Conservative Party membership, where almost everybody is of the sort of age that I won't disclose, but certainly not in the first flush of youth. Secondly, if you look at opinion polls asking about people's levels of trust in government, their levels of trust in politicians, the evidence seems to show, though I say seems to because it's quite controversial among political scientists, seems to show that levels of trust in politics, in democratic mechanisms, and in politicians have declined over the past 20 to 30 years. The level of trust in politicians disclosed in these surveys is extraordinarily low. Only journalists, I'm happy to say, become below politicians. Journalists are trusted by about 3% of the population. Politicians are trusted by about 7% of the population. If you go to Germany, unlike here, guess who's trusted most? Professors. This is not true in the UK. but in several countries, professors rank very highly in terms of trust mechanisms. So there seems to be, although I'll come back to this, assuming I get time, because there is some doubt about this, I think, an overall decline in trust in the political leaders on whom, in many contexts, we certainly still rely to play a key part in our lives. Third, there is reason to be concerned about the subversion of democracy by the rise, again, of Mr. Will Hutton, or at least the rise of the media. And I'm not getting at you, Will, here. It sounds though I'm not getting at you at all. And by the rise of the media, not so much the well-established Observer, but the electronic media and the impact of television on politics. I think it's undeniable now that the media, especially the electronic media, do not just report on politics. The electronic media constitute a great deal of what politics is about. So that if you're a politician, your first obligation every day tends to be to have to respond to the latest questions from the media. So if you're a politician, you're likely to respond to a program on TV or radio before you respond to questions in Parliament. And not only are you likely to respond before that, you have to do so on a continuous basis, because there is something like a day-to-day interrogation of politicians which the media carries on. It seems to me that the media actually stand in a kind of double relationship to democracy today. I think without the media, and without the proliferation of media, there would not be the spread of democracy across the world. The proliferation of media, the rise of global communications, have created the field for the expansion of democracy. Without television, no Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. Without television, probably no peaceful ending of apartheid in South Africa. Without television, probably no Tiananmen Square, although that turned out not to be an instance of successful democratization. The media, therefore, I think, open up space for political dialogue. They open up the space for a more active and reflexive citizenry. But they also relentlessly close down the very spaces which they've opened up by a kind of relentless trivialization, commercialization, and personalization of political issues, such that it's very hard to get longer-term political issues into media-induced debate. So I think it's right to say that we've become a media democracy. The media are central to what democratic mechanisms are all about. There's good reason to be worried about what the impact of this is. I should say, incidentally, that some people see this in a positive light, and this is quite interesting, certainly needs to be considered. Some people say that what we're seeing is the rise of a new form of direct democracy rather than representational democracy, which means that politicians are interrogated by the citizens all the time, are held responsible all the time. the media play, as their name suggests, a mediating role in this. And this, it suggested, become more important than orthodox mechanisms of representation. So there is a kind of electronic direct democracy. And that was expressed famously under the Clinton administration with the idea of one of the main advisors to Clinton, Dick Morris, when he said, every day is election day in America. Every day is election day in America. That means that you're always in dialogue with citizens, and citizens, therefore, are not likely to attribute so much importance to voting in elections. They're much more likely to attribute significance in terms of how far you deal with the constant fielding of issues which you have to carry on. So it followed from that that both politicians and the citizens are every day sort of watching the opinion polls and doing a sort of reflexive, having a kind of reflexive relationship to political life. We could discuss that at the end if you like. I think all that to me is extremely interesting. Does it follow that therefore is a crisis of democracy? Well, I think you must first of all offer a couple of reservations about this idea. I think there are structural strains in democratic countries. I think those structural strains, perversely, come from the same sources which have generalized democracy across the world. That's why it's an intriguing and difficult problem to cope with. But you have to be careful about overgeneralizing the idea of a crisis of democracy or a crisis of political apathy. Let me give you two brief reasons for this. First, apathy, especially if it's an active indifference to politics or an active capacity to ignore the state, can under some circumstances be said to be a key feature of what democracy is. You have to see the force of that by looking at what happens in countries which are not democratic, where the state is still the dominant force in people's lives. There's a joke that used to be told in East European countries. It's so remote from the experience of most people in West European countries that you might not get it, but the joke was that if you want to define a democracy, democracy is a society where someone knocks on your door at 4 a.m. and you think it's the milkman. Well, you don't get it, but I mean, in authoritarian states, I can assure you, you think it's the secret police. You don't think it's the milk. So capacity to ignore the state, capacity to express disinterest in politics to some kind of level, which is hard to specify, these are key features of a democratic society. If you ask which were the countries where levels of political participation were highest, well, they were always the non-democratic countries. The Soviet Union had voting rates of 99% in many of its elections, but I didn't think you would define it as intrinsically a highly democratic political system. So it's a subtle issue around all that. Very hard to say what the level of political disengagement would be that is compatible with the sustaining of a democracy, but a democracy is certainly a country where you can largely ignore the state if you want to. Will admires the state a bit more than I do. I think the state is often an enemy of the public sphere, not necessarily defender of the public sphere, and this, the more you verge towards an illiberal country, the more this is so. Second, if you look at the results of the last election in the UK, they're also very interesting. The last election, 2001, famously only 59% of the population voted in this election. And many people said, well, this is just manifest expression of the crisis in politics, just a manifest expression of the fact that there is a high level of political alienation. But if you look a bit more deeply, things look more, as usual, more subtle and more complicated. We have some very interesting studies done now of both the people who did vote in the last election and people who didn't vote in the last election. For Labour supporters here, which there may be some, one or two around still, the interesting finding is that of those who didn't vote in the election, a substantial majority would have voted Labour if they had have voted in that election. They simply thought the outcome, especially in their constituency, was so clear-cut That's a kind of game theoretical situation. They just had a free rider effect and they didn't vote. More interestingly, of those who didn't vote, 80% in a study carried out by the constitutional unit of University College, why isn't it the LSE? It should be at the LSE, but anyway, there is a constitution unit that monitors the political system in this country. It happens to be attached to UCL. They found that 80% of those who didn't vote gave their strong approval to the statement that voting is important. In other words, the fact they didn't vote was not a vote against the democratic system. And some of the people who didn't vote described their non-voting as kind of active non-voting, but the majority seemed to have been just thought it wasn't necessary to vote in that particular election. This finding is also, you can generalize it, there have been studies carried out of the whole range of industrial countries. They show that there, although often a level of disillusionment with political leaders, there is not a level of disillusionment with democracy. Something like 95% of the population in the industrial countries, if asked questions about democracy, say that they endorse the principle of democracy, they endorse the characteristics of democracy I mentioned earlier. If there is disillusionment, it's against how democracy is working, is not against the principle of democracy itself. Is there cause to be worried? Yes, I think there is. I don't think these remarks should suggest that there isn't cause to be worried. There are things we have to do. There are reforms we should try to make. What should they be? Well, since I've agreed to try and finish by 22, I'll mention them only briefly and then turn over to Will for an interchange and then to the audience for the last bit of the lecture. Let me suggest, there are more strategies that could suggest, but let me suggest three strategies which I think are important in most industrial countries, including this one. First, I think you can increase levels of both trust in politicians and democratic participation by returning politics to the people. Returning politics to the people sounds like just a demagogic phrase or rhetorical phrase, but what I mean by it is effective decentralization. As I've mentioned throughout these lectures, globalization has a double impact. It takes certain powers away from the nation into the wider global arena, but it pushes down, it enforces the need for more local autonomy. Decentralization of power, decentralization of democratic mechanisms is an appropriate, and I think we know it's an effective response to these changes. How do we know it? Well, we know it through the following sorts of studies. The very interesting study that compared different cities and different local areas around the world. And it found that levels of participation in local elections varied from about 30%, which it often is in this country, although it's sometimes lower in this country than that, 30% participation among voters, up to nearly 80% in local elections, as a kind of regular figure, not just a sporadic figure. What is the main difference? Well, the main difference, actually, it's really interesting, I think, is not anything to do with more ethereal mechanisms of democracy. It was simply the main correlation was how much tax-raising power the local region or the local city has. The higher the level of local tax-raising power, the greater the level of political participation. The reason is obvious. Voters are mostly rational people, and the more you see your vote makes a difference in the local arena, the more you're going to go along and make that vote. In the case of London, we know there is not true decentralization of power. Whatever you think of Ken Livingstone as a figure, the mayor has very limited powers in London. Personally, I think it would have been much more effective if the government had more thoroughgoing devolution and had devolved tax-raising powers in a more effective way to London. It would have helped with the tube issue as well as a general issue of resurgence of political involvement in London. So decentralization is one thing. Second, what I call the process of democratization of democracy, forgive the slightly pretentious phrase. What I mean by this is that even in democratic countries, the level of democratization, especially once you go above a minimal definition of democracy, is not enough. Most democratic countries, including this one, have been marked by the persistence of corruption, by male domination in political life. Still, you know, women have the vote, but women are not represented in most parliamentary and other committees in most countries in anything like the proportion that they should be. In many political systems, you've seen the persistence of old boy networks, of backstage deals, of ways of doing things in democracy which are not themselves democratic. I don't think there's a single democratic country where you would not find this to be the case. And I think you find a fairly close level of correlation again between the persistency of these practices and the actual level of political involvement. Look at a country like Denmark, where, so far as one can tell, these processes are relatively at a low level. The level of political participation in Denmark doesn't seem to have changed very much. We look at the US, where it's become increasingly obvious, I think, that money buys power, and the participation of big corporations, corporate power, very strongly influences presidential elections and also state elections. Level of participation has fallen off in most areas of the US. Thirdly, I feel we must have democratization above the level of the nation state, because so many things that now affect us happen above the level of the nation state. That's why I think democratization of the European Union, the current debate about the EU, is so important, because the European Union is at least attempting to pioneer a form of governance above the level of the nation. Now, I think we know the European Union is not democratic. Ulrich Beck, who's giving lectures here this term, which I thoroughly recommend if anyone gets a chance to go to them, visiting German sociologists, points out that the European Union would not get into itself, because you've got to be democratic to get into the European Union. The European Union is not democratic as measured by most indices. So there's a long way to go, but as a pioneering attempt of transnational governance, it is surely crucial. Moreover, the emergence of the European Union and the emergence of other regional associations can have a very positive effect for democratization within states. If you take the three examples I mentioned earlier, Spain, Portugal, Greece, very hard to see that they would have made either the economic progress or the political progress they've made without their involvement in the European Union. The European Union has done, I think, a wonderful job for those three particular states and for other states too. So a measure of democracy of the European Union was not just the democratization of EU institutions, but how far it facilitates the persistence or recovery of democracy within its member nations. And of course, a key test of that will be the entry of something like 10 more countries, including East European countries, over the next 3 or 4 years, something which seems very close at hand. But pioneer democracy above the level of the nation, we must. Well, there's a lot more to be said about that. There's a lot more to be said about all things I've talked about. Just to return to what I said a bit earlier, one of the great virtues of democracy is its ordinariness. Freud said that in therapy, the main thing is to turn someone from being highly depressive or deeply anxious into a state of ordinary unhappiness. Ordinary unhappiness is the most you can reasonably hope to manage for most people. Well, ordinary, boring democracy is the most you can manage for most countries. Don't slight it, because those countries that don't have democracy certainly recognize the difference. Thanks very much.
I just want to make a couple of observations and then pose Tony a couple of questions. I think the weakness in participation rates is more profound than Tony suggested, and speaks to not yet a crisis in democracy, but a potential crisis in democracy, which I'd like to take a minute outlining and then get his reaction to it. I take the view that there is a public realm beyond the private. And in that sense, I borrow from Aristotelian ideas and Kantian ideas. long tradition in Western philosophy along these lines. And the great thing about the Enlightenment, the European Enlightenment, where democracy really took off as an idea that people began to champion that should be incorporated into political processes, democracy was seen as a subset, if you like, of a vital public discourse. So that for Kant, arguing the case for democracy, or the case for his, as he was writing, the celebration of a public realm, his point was that at last, in Enlightenment Europe, there was a public sphere in which you could exchange information and ideas freely without censure from church or state. You could make scientific observation, you could make observation about the truth or not of religion, you were free to think as a free man or woman without actually having that constrained. And that ability to exchange other people those ideas were what he categorized as the public realm. Now, for me, that is the vital distinction, because the subset of the public realm is the state, because it's the state which actually is the custodian of actually the reality of publicness. We're not going to have free public museums unless the state taxes and provides them. And we're not going to have universality, which defines publicness, without the state. So Tony's right. I am friendly about the state. I think public institutions, of which the state are the most important, are a subset of the public realm and are actually fundamental to its operations. But if the state's to be efficient and the state's to be produce the outcomes we want, the processes have to be democratic. And that, of course, is the great lesson of the last 150 years. And here's my question to Tony. See, I think one of the reasons why participation rates are falling and why there is widespread apathy and why there is an emerging crisis of democracy is because I think the public realm in Western democracies is under threat because it's being progressively privatized. And that the rise of corporate power and the people who we elect to run our states, lack of conviction that they can and should do anything, because they're told from all sides that they're definitionally inefficient and they should get out of doing anything as much as they can, whether running a railway, running an underground system, or even running a university, should all be done by the private sector. You diminish the public realm. By diminishing the public realm, you actually diminish us as individuals, because our political imagination and our possibilities are actually narrowed. You actually shrink the state, you shrink the ambitions of the politicians who come forward to be elected to do things on our behalf, and you make actually the process by which public outcomes are made efficient, democracy, less vital. So for me, the precondition for democratic reform is actually the revival of the notion of the public realm, and that implies much more criticism about notions of privatization and much more willingness to challenge the extension of corporate and financial power. And that's the question I want to put to Tony. Do you see it like that as well?
Well, no, I don't. I think that's a very considerable oversimplification and actually not the way I'd look at it. I mean, there's a lot that I agree with, because I think it's crucial in contemporary societies to revive the public sphere. And there are two forms of democracy, as Will was alluding to. I didn't talk about one of them in this discussion, which is Habermas, probably, rather than Kant, who's developed. Democracy is not just being able to vote for people, it's being able to discuss issues publicly and openly without those issues being dominated by power, whether it's the power of corporations or the power of other organizations. Certainly true, that's a key feature of the public sphere. However, I think the public sphere has to be protected, if you like, both against corporate power and also against state power, because the history of the public sphere is its constant subversion by the state. States have killed far more people than any industrial corporation could in any way manage over the course of the 20th century. Europe is punctuated by the history of fascism, which is the enveloping of the public sphere by the state. The same thing happened in East European communism. So I prefer to say what we need in a society like Britain is something like a form of publicization, not privatization, not simply dependence on traditional mechanisms of the state, but a renewal of the public sphere, which has a different mix of the two. I mean, states have been inefficient, states have been bureaucratic. When you pay your taxes, you're giving it to Gordon Brown, the Treasury, who spend it as they see fit and may often waste it. There are all sorts of problems surrounding the state just as much as there are corporations. So personally, I think you have to deal with both sides of that equation if you're going to really have an effective renewal of the public sphere, which, however, we both agree, I think, is a desirable and necessary goal for democratic politics today.
I'm just going to do 15 seconds in reply, because I know we must throw it open. I think that part of the, Tony's answer is really intriguing. Is that whenever I have a dialogue with Tony, two things happen. We discover a lot of things in common, but the outlier things that we don't find in common are really illuminating.
And then we go out and have a big meal. This is a good part of this dialogue.
Publicization is a lovely idea, you know, brilliant idea. And that's what you are so good at. And I am in awe of it. And I'm going to champion that. Never come across it as a concept before. So 10 to 2 is quite an important moment in my life. But you see, I think your critique of the state, if I may say so, you've been invaded by the virus of American conservatism. I think it's seriously polluted you as a public intellectual over the last 5 years. I've got to make this quick, because I just don't think that it's fair to go at the state as being inefficient in that way. I think that taxation is citizens, our obligation as citizens to become a member of a public community. And I think that the job is to make the state less dysfunctional, to organize democratic processes that hold it to account. In other words, I'm shoulder to shoulder with enlightenment thinkers, if you like. We can have a smaller state, certainly, but the idea to be anti-state is a terrible step to take. Once you're in that place, you're disabling democratic process, because what is it that we vote for? So I'm for a twin-track approach, shoulder to shoulder with you on publicization, brilliant notion, but actually protecting, and one of the purposes of it, to protect and make more efficient and democratic the state. But we've now got 7 minutes left, so I should stop talking.
Well, actually, we haven't. My academic timing, I think, I'm really sorry to say it, but I think we've actually come to the end. I mean, as you could recognize, I think I've absolutely nothing to do with American conservatism at all. And where Bill got that idea from, I cannot possibly imagine. I think if you're a European Social Democrat, you have to learn both these lessons. That is, privatization has led to all sorts of problems in some areas and been successful in others. But the state also, especially a traditional bureaucratic state, has not delivered on democratic purposes. So you need state reform as well as you need regulation of markets. That's, I think, to me, that's where European social democracy has got to.
We're shoulder to shoulder, we agree with that.
Can I just say again, thanks to Will for coming. Thanks to everyone coming. Please give him a big clap. Thanks very much.